Two Texans, a Republican and a Democrat, both facing unexpected electoral challenges. What do these candidacies tell us about Texas politics? That and more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. How a Texas child custody case appears to set the stage for the next chapter in the political culture wars. Also, the rise in subprime lending for wheels. When it comes to auto loans in Texas, is a bubble beginning to form? What are the most essential Texas books? Got any ideas? Well, so does commentator W.F. Strong. We'll have a PolitiFact check and a whole lot more coming up when The Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, you've probably been tracking those impeachment hearings, haven't you? Oh, come on now, fess up. Yes, it's Texas Standard time on this 13th day of November 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us, especially so since we know our program's been preempted across much of the Lone Star State as NPR broadcast the first public hearing in the U.S. House of Representatives. Democrats there making their case to impeach Donald Trump. Meanwhile, some Trump loyalists, like Senator Lindsey Graham, say the process is un-American. We'll let you decide. But this much seems rather clear. The political landscape show ain't what it used to be. Wasn't that long ago we talked about Texas as the reddest of red states, remember? Not so sure that's true anymore. We'll learn a whole lot more in the next election cycle. But there are other anomalies worth taking a closer look at, too, and not just on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side as well. Case in point, consider this. A youthful Texas political figure with deep Latino ties, a former mayor who also served President Obama in Washington, a pedigree that would seem very attractive to many left of the political center line, or so the conventional wisdom might say. So riddle is this. When the Democrats take the stage in the next presidential debate, why is it likely that this particular politician will not be on that stage? John Moritz covers Texas politics and government for the USA Today Network. John, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Glad to be here.
You know which politician I'm referring to there?
I believe that would be Julian Castro, former
yes.
mayor of San Antonio and Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
That is correct. I mean, he's, I mentioned political pedigree, doesn't get a whole lot better than that. I mean, he served at the local level. He certainly knows his way around Washington. And yet, from what I understand, he may not be participating in the next Democratic presidential debate, and that may sound the bell for his candidacy, at least in the minds of some. What do you think?
Julian Castro, on paper, looks like a rising star for Democrats, not only in Texas, but around the country. He's young, he's smart, he's aggressive. I mean, he has been one of the more feisty debaters so far on the national stage. All of that is getting him a big fat 1 or 2% in the national polls. Interestingly enough, even with Beto O'Rourke's absence, he's not doing any much better in his home state. He has just yet to break through, and I'm sure it's frustrating to the campaign, and it's head-scratching to those of us who cover politics.
It's not, for, as you say, for lack of trying. I mean, he's taken a couple of good swings in these presidential debates, and in fact, after those debates, he's sort of been the focus of a lot of conversation. Why hasn't that worked for him, do you think?
Well, I think it's most likely because we have a crowded field of Democrats wanting to take on Trump. And one of the things you'll find in the internal numbers in the polling, that beating Donald Trump seems to be way, way up there. And I would imagine that former Vice President Biden is the recipient of that particular sentiment. He's a known quantity. He's beloved by, you know, a lot of your old-time Democrats, especially those in the middle of the road. And in states that are not Texas and some of the early ones, the middle of the road is where the Democratic Party base is. They've had to forge coalitions in states like Iowa and some of the early primary states, and whereas Texas has not been a Democratic state. So therefore, the party base shifts to the left because, you know, that's where the center of gravity is pulling them.
Mm-hmm. It seems like Castro has been rather open about his difficulties in fundraising. At one point, didn't he threaten to drop his campaign, his pursuit of the White House?
He did. He set like an arbitrary figure of $800,000 to raise by the end of October. He made it, which allowed him to continue. But the fundraising is not his biggest problem. It's breaking through the polling thresholds that are unforgiving as we get on, you know, closer to the primaries and caucuses. The saving grace possibly could be is that once the caucuses and primaries actually begin, these national debates take on less importance and it becomes a state-by-state slog. If he can make it to Nevada, survive South Carolina, and then participate in Super Tuesday in Texas and California and, mm-hmm. and some of the other states where there is a base hospitable to what he's saying, then perhaps he can go forward.
And just to be clear about this threshold on the polls, he's had to make a certain threshold to make it to the stage in the next Democratic round of Democratic debates, right?
Yeah, he's got to do well in a complicated scenario of polling. He has not met any of the thresholds as far as I have checked.
Now, from what I understand, Castro has said that he's moving the focus of his campaign away from places like Iowa and New Hampshire because they don't reflect the diversity of the Democratic Party. In fact, he's gone so far as to say they shouldn't even be first in the primary or caucus process. Is that trying to put a spin on a picture that's not looking so good for himself right now, or is there something to that?
There's a little bit of that. He's also, if you've noticed, he's set his sights most recently on Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Uh-huh. And polling suggests that Mayor Pete's support is from mostly the white left of center voters. And that's who make up Iowa and New Hampshire.
Right.
And so what he's what Castro was trying to do is saying if Buttigieg does do well in those early states, it's in a constituency that is not representative of the larger Democratic base.
John Moritz covers Texas government and politics for the USA Today Network. John, great to talk with you again. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
The only woman representing Texas Republicans at the federal level, and one of the most senior Republican women in the U.S. House, could be facing her most competitive re-election yet. Fort Worth Congresswoman Kay Granger has comfortably held her seat for 12 terms, but a challenge coming from within her own party has political observers taking note. One of those observers is a rather familiar voice here on the Texas Standard. That's Abby Livingston, Washington Bureau Chief of the Texas Tribune. Abby, good to talk with you again. Thanks so much for taking time out to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
Who is challenging Kay Granger and why exactly?
Well, it's a gentleman named Chris Putnam. He is a former Colleyville City Council member. I will caveat, Colleyville is not in the district. It neighbors the district. It's for your non-DFW listeners. It's a suburb between Dallas and Fort Worth. And he is very much tied into the local Tea Party, the conservative activist group, which many people who follow Texas Republican politics knows that the Northeast corner of Tarrant County is a very potent conservative bastion. Mm-hmm. And so he is of that group. And so he is challenging her. And he's come off to quite a start with his early fundraising.
Granger, 12-term incumbent. What's behind her history in that district? And why has she been so popular?
Well, she ran and won the seat in 1996. And it's important to remember that Texas used to be a Democratic state, and that was at the point when the state was moving from Democratic to Republican. And the seat had long been held by Democrats, including former Speaker, the late Speaker Jim Wright. She was mayor of the town. She was viewed as, I don't think a lot of people could read her politics, and so she was recruited by both sides. And she ended up, I would assume, sensing the political winds, that's maybe reading a little bit of motive that maybe I shouldn't, but she went with the Republicans who were on the ascent in the state of Texas. And I went through the numbers. She's never won a primary with less than, I think, 70% of the vote. And the general elections are complete blowouts. Even last year when Congressman O'Rourke had his, you know, phenom Senate race, it was still a solidly Republican seat. And I will also add, it extends west into Parker County and north into Weiss County.
But I want to get back to the optics of this. I mean, we've been talking for a while with Republican strategists who say, you know, one of the real vulnerabilities that Texas Republicans face is that their tent is not as broad as it needs to be. And here we're talking about the only Republican woman at the federal level representing the Lone Star State. Are there concerns among Republican strategists that that this could look bad for Texas Republicans? That, if anything, we need to recruit and secure the seats for more women candidates?
Well, I will preface that there are female Republican candidates running elsewhere in the state, including the neighboring 24th district. But they've had a really hard time in the last couple decades getting through primaries. And up to until last year, the Democrats had a similar problem of Democratic candidates not getting through. The primary voters rejected them. But I would stress this is not a Texas problem. This is a national problem. And I think with Granger, I mean, these numbers nationally in the House GOP conference are dwindling. And when I talk to young Republican women in Washington, the refrain I'm starting to hear is, I don't see myself in the conference anymore, that there's just fewer and fewer people for young Republican women to look toward who are like themselves. And on top of that, Granger's somewhat of a mentor to some of the younger members. And one thing we hadn't talked about yet is she is the top Republican on the House Appropriations Committee, which is one of the most powerful positions. It's hard to explain what that gig is, but it's extremely dominant, and it would be a massive blow to the delegation and its power structure as well.
We've been talking with Abby Livingston. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune. Abby, good to talk with you again. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us on The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What you seeing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. Impeachment hearings, the talk of social media, that term, yeah, trending on Twitter while on Facebook. We're seeing several responses to the testimony on Capitol Hill this Wednesday. As part of our Facebook watch party, Janice Hitchcock says Republican legislators' calls for the anonymous whistleblower at the center of the hearings to be subpoenaed are a red herring. No one should care who they are, Janice says. What they said has already been confirmed by the president himself. And Christopher Bailey says calling for the whistleblower's name is undeniably the equivalent of witness intimidation. Meanwhile, Corey Weber says this about complaints from the president and his supporters that the investigation is yet another so-called witch hunt. Corey says the Mueller investigation was started by Republicans with a Republican running it. It was never to find collusion. It was to find out what happened with Russian interference. Obviously going to be a lot more news to unpack from this going forward, so we'll keep an eye on that and other stories unfolding on social media. I'll be back with more later in the broadcast.
Well, you heard the man, Texas. Tweet us and let us know what's making news in your part of the Lone Star State, or maybe you're keeping up with those hearings. Let us know your impressions, too. At Texas Standard, Wells Dunbar, back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
Business and your money on The Standard. I'm David Brown. The largest dairy producer in the country is Dallas-based Dean Foods, and now it's filing for bankruptcy. Dallas Morning News reporting the company behind labels including True Moo and Dairy Pure has faced some difficulties in recent years. One of those is an overall decline in milk consumption. Dean Foods is currently in talks to sell the company to the co-op Dairy Farmers of America. Dean has plants in Dallas, McKinney, El Paso, San Antonio, and Lubbock. Now, having said all that, startup businesses in Texas seem to be doing better here than in other parts of the United States. That's one reason that Comparison, a company that reviews business systems, named Texas number one among the 50 states on its new list of best places to start a business. Among the factors that they were considering, new business applications, year-over-year growth of new business applications, corporate tax rate, labor cost, cost of living index, even the number of college graduates in the state. The Wichita Falls Times Record News reports that with zero corporate income tax rate, of course, business survival rate of over 50% after 5 years, and nearly 300,000 new business applications. The sum of those numbers put Texas right on top.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. If you've watched Texas politics for a while, you'll remember the angst and acrimony of the 2017 legislature, and specifically the so-called bathroom bill. That proposal would have required transgender persons to use bathrooms in public schools, government buildings, and public universities based on what the bill called one's biological sex. It was seen by opponents as indicative of a hard right turn on social issues, one that divided many Republicans themselves. Well, the bill didn't pass, and after a relatively drama-free 2019 legislative session, it appeared everyone had moved on. Well, not so fast, apparently. Caitlin Burns is a freelance journalist who's been writing for Vox about what could be a new front in the political culture wars here in Texas and maybe beyond. Caitlin, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, this political front in the culture wars I'm referring to has to do with transgender issues. Last month, Governor Greg Abbott tweeted that the Texas Attorney General's Office and the State Department of Family and Protective Services were looking into the case of a 7-year-old child at the center of a custody dispute. Why exactly?
So, in essence, the case was a matter of two divorced parents who just simply disagree about their child's gender identity. The mom affirms the fact that the child identifies as a girl, and the father doesn't seem to want anything to do with that. And that's basically the long and short of the case.
Now, just to be clear, there's been a lot of disinformation around this case. Before we go much deeper, I suppose we should point out that this has been, the child has been at the center of this custody battle. A jury has come down with an opinion, and a judge has weighed in as well. Where does this child stand now when it comes to the question of custody?
Yeah, so the jury voted 11-1 to give the mother full custodianship, which is interesting because the mother didn't even petition for full custodianship in the first place. She simply asked the court to have the father be respectful of the child's self-identification as a girl. 2 days later, Judge Cooks, who's a Dallas area judge, came in and threw the jury decision out in an unusual legal move and granted the father joint custodianship, joint decision making over medical decisions for the child, and gave him an extra day of custody, a school day, which is a big deal because the child is currently registered for school as a girl.
I want to ask you about some of the reaction to this. Shortly after the jury's verdict, Senator Ted Cruz tweeted that the jury's decision was horrifying and tragic, and he went on to say that for a parent to subject such a young child to life-altering hormone blockers to medically transition their sex is nothing less than child abuse. And then the president weighed in, calling it, and I quote here, "This is child abuse. People need to start to stand up against this," expletive deleted. "Enough is enough," close quote. What is that about? Are there medical procedures planned for this child?
Not at this time. The nearest time that the child would be subject to any sort of medical treatment is in at least 2 to 4 years after her puberty starts. So a 7-year-old child is not experiencing puberty. There's absolutely no need for any medical interventions for a 7-year-old. At that point, transition is just a difference of hair, name, pronoun, and maybe how they dress. That's it. There are absolutely no medical procedures for a transgender 7-year-old child.
Well, which brings us to the whole issue of the disinformation around this case, because I've seen articles out there that say that the child isn't experiencing any sort of gender dysphoria, and the child dresses like a boy going to school and that sort of thing. It's hard to tell what exactly is what in this case, but moreover, the politicization, it seems to me, of what is essentially a child custody dispute around a child and the issues regarding that child's gender that have come up in the process of this custody dispute. What is this telling us about Texas, about politics, about who we are, about our culture?
I will say that we are caught in this moment where the sort of right wing of the political system loves to use trans people as a wedge issue. And I think they've seized upon this case where the father in the case actually ran a whole social media campaign to bring attention to this, actually ended up raising over $130,000 for his own behalf off of this case while also violating the privacy of the family. I think that we're in just a really interesting cultural moment where every little thing that can be used to attack the trans community gets blown up all over national news.
Let's back up and think about the larger implications here. Here we are talking about what is, I think we both acknowledge, is a very private matter, a case involving child custody. How is this going to play out, especially as we look toward 2020?
I think you're going to end up seeing the issue of trans children specifically being used as a wedge issue. There have been several Texas legislators who have suggested that they'll propose a bill that would ban all medical treatments for any underage trans person. And we're starting to see that spread to other states as well. So I think we've seen Ohio, Tennessee, Georgia, and a couple other states intimate that they are going to produce similar legislation.
Caitlin Burns is a freelance journalist who's been writing for Vox about this story. Caitlin, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard. Good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Two NASA astronauts are about to undertake the most complicated space repair job in a decade. Houston Chronicle reporting the spacewalk scheduled for tomorrow. I should change that. It's actually Friday, I believe. It's the first of four to fix a vital piece of hardware not meant to be repaired in space. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer has been in space since 2011, long past its expected three-year lifespan. NASA hopes that these repairs will help the equipment collect data on cosmic ray events for another 11 years. We're fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour. Texas Standard Time's a whole lot more of the Standard just around the corner. Stick around.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Today, a U.S. House committee led by a Texas Democrat is examining a proposed regulation from the Environmental Protection Agency. The measure would require scientists to disclose their raw data, including confidential medical records, in order for the EPA to consider their studies. Members of the scientific community say the policy would undermine government research and the rulemaking process. Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson of Dallas chairs the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee. She raised concerns the rule would prevent the agency from using the best available science and therefore endanger the public. Johnson requested the questioned the EPA's Dr. Jennifer Orme-Zavaleta today.
In your nearly 40 years at EPA, can you personally recall any instance in which considering less science led to a better policy decision by the agency?
So my time at EPA has been in a variety of different facets, some involving some rulemaking. So I can't speak to that specifically from my own experience.
The EPA plans to release a supplemental proposal to the Strengthening Transparency in Regulatory Science rule early next year for public comment. Some Texas parents are calling on state lawmakers to protect families from mistaken child abuse allegations. During a Texas House Human Services Committee hearing Tuesday, they told legislators reports from state-funded pediatricians resulted in them losing custody of their children for weeks or even months. Tim Timmerman said a doctor accused him of shaking his four-month-old baby.
I urge this committee to put yourselves in the shoes of my family and think about how you would feel if your child or grandchild was taken out of your arms with no standard of proof other than the opinion of a single individual.
Committee Chair James Frank says he plans to hold more hearings on the issue. Some Texas communities are thawing out today following their first freeze of the season. An early blast of Arctic air has consumed most of the state since Monday, bringing record low temperatures to several regions. National Weather Service meteorologist Rick Hallman in Brownsville says ambient temperatures in some parts of South Texas fell from the low 90s to the mid-30s since the week began.
Seasonal norms typically this time of year, upper 70s to near 80 is a high. So we're 20 to 30 degrees below normal on the high temperature. Low temperatures, low 60s typically, so we're about 20 degrees lower on that.
Hallman says warmer weather is expected Thursday. And iconic Road Stop Buc-ee's is Texas Road Stop Buc-ee's is branching out into Georgia. The Lake Jackson-based company is scheduled to break ground in a new location near Macon on Monday. It opened its first store outside of Texas in Alabama. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. Ever heard of Banco Santander? Well, if that sounds to the ear like the name of some Spanish conglomerate, you're not too far off. It's actually a multinational commercial bank based in Madrid, Europe's largest, in fact, and among its many branches, a Dallas company called Santander Consumer USA, which brings us to our story. In the world of auto loans, Santander has a specialty. Loans to people of low income or who can't afford down payments. And now Santander is ramping up sales in Texas, a state which just so happens to have the highest auto loan burden in the whole U.S. of A. Mitchell Schnurman has been writing about this for the Dallas Morning News. Mitchell, welcome back to the Standard.
Hey, I appreciate being here, David. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Sounds like a lot of Texans who have auto loans, though, aren't doing so well. Where do we stand in terms of auto loan defaults here in the Lone Star State? Are those numbers out there?
Yeah, they're really rising, and they're rising pretty sharply. So at the end of 2018, which is the most recent numbers we have, 5.4% of Texans had loans that were at least 90 days late or longer. That's almost twice as many as before the Great Recession. The numbers had been declining for five consecutive years. They've been ticking up since 2016. Hmm. Yeah, you mentioned Santander. And they're kind of an extreme example because they focus on this subprime borrower, and they've got almost 15% of their loans are at least 60 days late or shorter, 30 to 60 days.
Wow.
So they've got a rising number.
Now, help me understand this then. In the middle of all of this, and that this sounds at least to me like a rather ugly picture, they want to ramp up their activity here in Texas?
Well, they've been doing it. I mean, this was interesting when I talked to their CEO. We're asking them about these signs of distress. And what he said is, we've got 30 PhDs that specialize in statistics, and we're always looking for this. We're looking for signs that the consumer is pulling back. And frankly, we don't see it. That was his quote. We don't see it. So they are plowing full speed ahead. In fact, in the latest quarter, ended in September, they originated over $8 billion in loans and leases, and that was an 11% increase year over year. So when you're growing 11%, you're certainly not pulling back.
You know, I have to confess that when I hear someone say, we've got X number of PhDs on this, it sort of reminds me of an attitude that used to be described as the smartest guys in the room. I'm sort of wondering about this approach. I mean, they say that they're not seeing any signs that we may be headed toward a rough economic outlook in the long term. They feel rather confident. And yet, what is it, one in five of the loans that they have that they presume are just going to be delinquent, that they're going to fail?
Yeah, that what they had in the latest quarter was 18%, so that's almost one in five of their auto loans people eventually default on. I think that's just the nature of this business. But, you know, some of this, it's not just the borrower's fault. I mean, consider this with Santander. They just floated in August $1 billion in bonds that were backed by these auto loans. S&P reported that only 3.3% of the applicants, 3.3%, mm-hmm. did Santander even verify their income.
Wow.
All right. The average loan-to-value rate for this entire book of business was over 100%. So if you're paying more than 100% for a car, a depreciating asset, and you're not verifying their income levels, mm-hmm. I would say don't be surprised if you have problems later. Now, when you bring up the smartest guys in the room, we talked a lot about the housing crisis, and they insist this is not the housing crisis. There's a lot of differences between mortgage loans and car loans. The value of them, in Texas, for instance, the average mortgage is $170,000 and it's $23,000 for cars.
Let me ask you something. Santander has been accused in the past of taking advantage of folks who don't have a lot of money. How do they answer those charges, those accusations?
You know, they couldn't really run away from them because there's a long, I call it in my headline, a rap sheet practically on them. They, in addition to all their various other things they've been called on, I mean, they've been sued by the Massachusetts Attorney General. There was a $22 million settlement, and the allegation was that they were selling unaffordable car loans to people. They were putting them in cars they couldn't afford. They also paid almost a $10 million fine for repossessing cars illegally from members of the military. Now, what the company says is that's kind of behind them. That was a previous management. They overhauled management over the last 4 and 5 years. They made a lot of changes in how they approach things. They insist that you know, they're really committed to protecting consumers now. But I think we've got to wait and see whether we really buy that or not. Well, one place that it's really working is on Wall Street. These guys had an IPO in 2014. By 2016, they lost two-thirds of their value. They finally climbed back up. Wow. And so far this year, with their dividends, they're up over 50%. So Wall Street likes what they see.
Mitchell Schnurman is columnist for the Dallas Morning News. He's been following this story. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Mitchell, good to talk with you. Thank you, sir.
Have a good day, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It was 50 years ago today that a group of students at a school now known as Texas State University took a stand against the war in Vietnam. The protesters, now remembered as the San Marcos Ten, faced serious consequences for speaking out. And as Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports, those consequences still echo on college campuses today.
It's an unusual college reunion.
Okay, look, I'm right here.
Michael Holman is pointing at a photograph taken 50 years ago.
I'm looking over at Murray, thinking, who is that idiot?
Murray Rosenwasser squints at the grainy black and white photo.
I am right there.
In the photograph, they and eight others were sitting cross-legged in the grass at Southwest Texas State University, now Texas State University, and they were surrounded by a mob.
You talk about being outnumbered. Look at that. And they were not happy.
It started out as a silent demonstration against the Vietnam War. About 70 students sat in the grass and held signs that read peace. This is not at all shocking for a college campus in 1969, but this was in conservative Texas, and the college administration was not going to tolerate it.
And they gave us 3 minutes to vacate, and all but 10 of us did.
Those 10 became the San Marcos 10, which included Sally Ann Satige.
And then we were surrounded by kickers and jocks. They shouted horrible things to us.
But that wasn't the worst of it. Dean Floyd Martin had warned the protesting students to disperse or they would be suspended. Michael Holman.
They were wrong. I said it then, I said it now, and I'll continue to say it. They were wrong with what they did, and by God, I'm glad I sat there and told them.
The San Marcos 10 were suspended for a year and ordered to immediately clean out their dorm rooms, but the fight wasn't over yet. To get an idea what all of this means, you have to look back at the times.
In my opinion, for us to withdraw from that effort would mean a collapse not only of South Vietnam, but Southeast Asia. So we're going to stay there.
A week earlier, on November 3, 1969, President Nixon gave a primetime televised address about the war. Nixon had run for president, promising to end the war, but this night he outlined his policy of continued fighting.
I can order an immediate, precipitate withdrawal of all Americans from Vietnam without regard to the effects of that action. or we can persist in our search for a just peace.
And Nixon also took aim at the anti-war protesters. He said their demonstrations were prolonging the war by giving hope to the communists that America would soon withdraw. And it was by uniting in support of the war that we could win it.
So tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace. I have initiated a plan of action which will enable me to keep that pledge. The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed.
Nixon's speech added fuel to the war protest across America and even across Texas. Up I-35 at the University of Texas, about 1,500 students gathered peacefully to hear anti-war speeches. At Texas Tech in Lubbock, some students wore black armbands. At SMU in Dallas, students read a list of the 2,200 Texans who had died in Vietnam. It was only in San Marcos that students were suspended, and the San Marcos 10 then challenged their suspensions in federal court on grounds that their right to free speech was violated.
We feel like we have a constitutional right, and the ACLU says, well, we kind of think you do too.
E.R. Bills is the author of the book, The San Marcos 10, An Anti-War Protest in Texas.
Eventually, they were granted an injunction against the university. Well, in the higher courts, they lost their case. They appealed it to the Supreme Court and eventually lost there.
This set a legal precedent that stands today. The legal standard is frequently cited in court battles across the nation about free speech. Schools and universities can put restrictions on the time, place, and manner of free speech activities. David Martin Davies reporting.
Well, if you haven't yet heard or felt it, we are currently in a record-breaking Arctic blast. New York Times reporting that in one day, McAllen, Texas, went from a heat index of 92 degrees to a wind chill of 31. Netflix time? Commentator W.F. Strong may have a better idea. Bundle up tight, light a fire, and get in the mood for a good read.
I read about 2 books a week, and order 2 more I'm unlikely to ever get to. Admittedly, I'm often short of shelves. I recently took a pickup load of recyclable metals to a solid waste depot. As I paid the man, I noticed he had 20 books on a little shelf outside his office. I said, well, you have plenty to read when things are slow. He said, no, I'm not much of a reader, but I can't stand seeing good books go to the dump. So I save them. These are rescue books for anybody who wants them. I rescued 5 books from the rescue books. Doing some math, I figure that if I live to my allotted average age, I figure I have only 2,000 books left to read in my life, and probably only 1,500 because I'll reread 500 of my favorites, leaving 1,500 new books over the next 20 years out of billions in the world. A sad fraction. So how does one choose well? First, you have recommendations from friends whose taste you trust. I rely also on sites like Texas Book Lover on Facebook for suggestions worth my time. But my favorite of all are books about books. McMurtry has an exquisite book called simply Books. It's truly spellbinding. A similar sort of work that I want to recommend to you today is 101 Essential Texas Books by Glenn Drumgoole and Carlton Stowers, both authors and experts on Texas literature. You'll find your favorites here for sure. All the Pretty Horses, The Time It Never Rained, Lone Star by Fehrenbach, Michener's Texas, Friday Night Lights, and Lonesome Dove, but you will also find numerous gems you've perhaps never come across. Texas Post Office Murals by Philip Parisi is a full-color book of 115 photographs of Depression-era murals painted in Texas post offices across the state. A History of Texas Music by Gary Hartman. It's not limited to country western. Hartman covers German, Czech, Tejano, Cajun, rock and roll, and rhythm and blues. 100,000 Hearts, a Surgeon's Memoir by Denton Cooley, one of the world's best heart surgeons of all time. And I'm not just saying that because one of those 100,000 hearts still beating is mine. Under the category of place, you have Goodbye to a River by John Graves and A.C. Green's A Personal Country, as one would expect. The lesser-known standout for me is Great Lonely Places of the Texas Plains by the Texas poet Walt MacDonald and Texas genius photographer Wyman Menzer. And last we have Rainwater by Sandra Brown. Sandra Brown is best known for her bestsellers in romance and suspense. So this work is a departure for her. Set in a small Texas town during the Depression, it has been compared to The Grapes of Wrath. It is the story of a tough woman barely surviving while running a boarding house in the Dust Bowl. Well, that's a quick preview. Check out the 101 Essential Texas Books, and you'll be sure to find many you'll cherish having on your shelves, or if you're like me, stacked on your desk or on top of the dining room table, piano, refrigerator, night table, etc. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong, Fulbright Scholar, Professor of Culture and Communication, University of Texas, RGV. Check out his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Has every newly elected Democratic president been a Washington outsider and a torchbearer for a new generation? Yes, says a Washington outsider and a wannabe torchbearer for a new generation. But is he right? I think I know who might have an answer. Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas is back in the house. Good to see you again, Madeline.
Good to see you, too.
She's looking at claims and checking them twice. PolitiFact Texas, of course, based at the Austin American Statesman. I suppose we should say up front that this claim is somewhat self-serving, right?
That's definitely true. The speaker here is Democrat Pete Buttigieg, who's running for president. He's the mayor, right? That's exactly right. And he was asked by a reporter about some of the other Democratic candidates running in the race right now, specifically former Vice President Joe Biden.
Who is not a Washington outsider.
He is not a Washington outsider, that's for sure. And Buttigieg took the opportunity to make a pitch for himself as an outsider who could do a good job as president. And this is what he said.
Also say when it comes to electability, every single time my party has won the presidency in the last 50 years, it's been with a candidate who was new on the national scene, hadn't spent a lot of time in Washington, and represented a new generation of leadership.
All right, so how did we pull this one apart? You know, when I first heard 50 years ago, we're talking, what, the Nixon administration or something?
Right, so exactly 50 years ago takes us to 1969, but obviously there was not a presidential election that year. And in 68, Nixon was elected, so we can't really look at a Democrat who was victorious that year. So the next presidential year that we can look at is 1976. Mm-hmm. And from then on, we can look at each Democratic presidential nominee who was successfully elected to serve in the office, and we can determine whether or not they were new on the national scene when they became the nominee and were eventually elected.
I'm just thinking that's not a whole lot of people.
It's not a whole lot. It actually is three people. We've got Jimmy Carter, we've got Bill Clinton, and we've got Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And certainly there were other elections between then, but obviously we're not looking at these candidates when they're the incumbent running for re-election, because by then they're definitely not a political outsider when it comes to seeking the presidency.
Right, and we're not talking about Republicans who were elected the presidency. We're talking about Democrats.
That's right. He said members of his own party.
Right. Okay. So let's see. Jimmy Carter. He was a plains farmer and the governor of Georgia, as I recall.
That's right. At that point, when he became the Democratic Party nominee, he had not previously held elected federal office. Experts we spoke to said he falls pretty safely in the category of a political outsider at that point.
All right. Let's fast forward to 1992. I believe it was an Arkansas governor.
That's
was
right.
Running against an incumbent Republican president.
That's right. And again, at this point, Clinton had not held federal office. But some of the experts we consulted said it's questionable whether you could say that he fits the definition of being new to the national scene at this point, because he was fairly well known in Democratic Party leadership circles at that point. Mm-hmm. He'd been the Arkansas governor for more than a decade. He served as the chair of the National Governors Association and of the Democratic Leadership Council.
Right.
So while he'd never held federal office, he was certainly a figure who was known by many in Democratic circles.
Definitely.
So we could argue back and forth.
Yeah, right. Of course. Okay. So, but he had not actually served in Washington, I suppose.
That's right.
That's fair to say. Okay. So fast forward then to Barack Obama, who I think I remember first seeing at a Democratic convention giving a speech, and then he was a senator from Illinois.
That's right. So in the 2008 election, at that point, Obama had been a U.S. senator. He hadn't even completed his first term in the Senate. And you're right to call out that speech that he gave in 2004. That was really the first time he'd made any splash nationally. And his time in the U.S. Senate, again, it was still his first term. So experts agreed that he also could be fit in this category of being a political outsider.
Okay, so he could be a political outsider, but he was serving in Washington at the time.
That's right. But during the primary election that year, he was successful over Hillary Clinton, who was definitely an establishment figure by that point in time.
Okay,
so if you put the two of them next to each other, he certainly was the political outsider.
One is more insider than the other, for
That's
sure.
Right.
That's, yeah. All right. So we ready for a rating on this one?
I think we are.
All right. Well, Madeline, what does PolitiFact Texas have to say about this claim by Pete Buttigieg?
We rated this claim mostly true.
Mostly true is the rating from PolitiFact Texas on Pete Buttigieg's claim that when it comes to electability, every single time the Democrats have won the presidency in the last 50 years, it's been with a candidate who was new on the national scene, hadn't spent a lot of time in Washington, and represented a new generation of leadership. Madeline, good to see you again. Thanks so much for stopping in.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Oh, yes, you are. Joining us now in our studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. I'm wondering how many folks are listening to us today because we're, you know, of course, in many places, we're being preempted by the big news on the national
level. Yeah, definitely. You know, and we tried to reach out to our listeners on social media, let them know that there's alternate ways of enjoying the show. And so obviously that is the case. And, you know, that's probably going to be the case going forward because there's a hearing today. There's going to be hearings on Friday. This story is just going to continue to really generate a lot of attention. So we have been doing our best to follow it on social media. We have the video. You can watch everything on our Facebook page.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
My question is whether or not this is actually going to generate a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Because it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that certainly in the first day, people are going to be going to be watching it.
I saw this great tweet from Rick Perlstein, a great historian, author of some really good books about Nixon, Ronald Reagan.
Right.
He says he was asking, are these impeachment hearings going to pass the Cookie Monster test? And he was referring to Watergate and how widely viewed they were that Sesame Street ended up lampooning them. You see the Cookie Monster like eating the microphone.
Right.
And this joke of Watergate. And it has been, you know, pretty dry, pretty legal, what we've seen everything today. So, you know, the question does remain.
Well, you know, I think the Cookie Monster was preempted, as I recall, on a lot of PBS
stations.
That's
true as well.
Yeah,
but it seems to be widely available everywhere, too. I think all the major networks have cut in for coverage. So,
again,
a story we're continuing to cover and pretty much everyone else is. Well, shifting gears, here's an interesting story that's flying a little bit under the radar, but lots of folks are still chiming in on. A State Department official from Dallas is under fire after embellishments about attending Harvard, speaking at both the Democratic and Republican national conventions, and even appearing on the cover of Time magazine.
Are you sure she appeared on the cover of Time magazine?
Let's get into it here.
Uh-huh.
Pretty wild story from NBC News concerning one Amina Chang. She is the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stability Operations, and her chief qualification for the post appeared to be time as the CEO of a small nonprofit. And in this video posted to the group's website, this interview touts Chang's appearance on the cover of Time magazine, even cuts away to the counterfeit cover, which Chang graciously acknowledged.
Did you hear that, folks? Counterfeit cover?
Apparently she provided the cover herself, and NBC News has a copy of it, and it's straight up her on the cover of Time magazine, which of course they reached out to Time. They said, no, that was not a real cover there. She also implied that she testified before Congress and was a graduate of the Army War College, neither of which appear to be true either. So very interesting story here on our Facebook page. Matt Weiss says, had their face on a fake Time cover. Now, where have I heard that before? I think referring to, down at Mar-a-Lago, President Trump had this one of those fake Yeah. You know, you can find them at, like, you know,
buy
anywhere,
those at the shopping mall
back
or
in the
something.
Day. Yeah. But, you know, she appears to have retained her post for now, but NBC notes she was being considered for a much higher promotion, basically overseeing all international development work in Asia with a $1 billion budget.
$1 billion budget. Wow.
Results, yeah.
Listen, we'd love to hear what's making news in your part of Texas. As always, reach out to us on the social media platform of your choice. You know what to put in there, Texas Standard. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We hope you join us again tomorrow. Till then, have a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.